Her first memoir and her second one have been praised for their bone-deep honesty as much for their vivid, absorbing prose. More than one reviewer says Mary Clearman Blue writes books that catch you up, take you fully and completely into her world, books you want to read in one sitting. On this edition of Conversations, we'll talk with Mary Clearman Blue about her writing and her family, the five generations who settled and made their lives on the hard Montana landscape, and of whom she's written so eloquently. I'm Susan McGinnis. This is Conversations. Mary, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I want to ask you first about two almost bare mentions you make, in each of the two books. In one, you talk very briefly about what you call Montana's glamour. And in the other one, you talk about the lure of the West. You say, you talk about the romantic, despairing tradition of the West that had been luring boys away from their homes since Wild Bill's Wild West show and the like. When your great-grandfather, Abraham Hoagland, came to Montana, was he following that lure, or was this a more practical man?
Oh, certainly he was practical, because he was a graduate engineer and a surveyor, and he came with a job. He was surveying for the Great Northern Railroad, came to Central Montana because of the work. There's no doubt in my mind, though, that he thought it was pretty glamorous what he was doing, because he kept notes all the way through, and the language that he uses, the way he tries to describe it, suggests to me that he had in mind the great adventure, and that he was pretty excited about this new place he was finding.
Do you think he passed that excitement to his son, who then passed it to his son? My sense is that both Alfred and Jack, your dad, were cowboys.
Yeah, and I think that I don't think they had the perspective he had. He had grown up in Pennsylvania, and he attended Lafayette College and graduated with honors, with an engineering degree, and was very widely read. Read some remarkable books, Shakespeare and Pope, and a lot of lesser knowns in 18th and 19th century literature, and he had seen a little bit of the world. Neither Albert, my grandfather, nor my father, Jack, ever spent much time out of Montana, and as far as I can see, neither ever wanted to. My dad used to say things like, "I've never lost anything out of the state," and was positively incensed at the idea anybody would want to travel abroad. He was interested in the West and his own. Now, he would have loved to have come to Alaska.
That would have been more West.
Yeah, that would have been more West from his point of view.
Right. Give us a contrast to the romance. It feels to me like Jack's life and the women's lives were very, very hard lives. Albert's was easier, but theirs was very hard on a hard land.
It was very hard, and one of the reasons it was hard was that Montana went into a cycle of drought, and there were weather changes in the weather patterns that nobody could have predicted. In fact, when my parents were married, there was a 10-year drought period that everybody talked about in my childhood with awe, where no grass grew. The other thing that happened, of course, is the Great Depression, and it seemed to have affected some of the agricultural parts of the West much, much earlier and much more harshly than the urban West or the two coasts. And my parents took that for granted. They seemed to think that was just how the world was, and that hard work and making do without and living in that incredible way was just how it was. And of course, all their friends were living in the same way. Nobody had any money, and they took that for granted.
Your dad's kind of praised the virtues of austerity, but your mom was a little more tight-jawed about it, it seems. This was a grim life for her.
Yeah. It was a lonely life. It was, I don't remember, and we weren't that by remote by, for example, some Alaska standards. We lived 30 miles from a town of about 3,000 people, but the roads were gumbo, and it meant that sometimes they were impassable.
You should tell us what gumbo
and,
is.
Well, gumbo is, gumbo is this great mud that we have in Montana, and there I have in other places in the country, but I think it's only called gumbo there. At least that's the only place I've ever heard the word, and whether it's got anything to do with the southern stew, I don't know. But it's the kind of mud that builds up on your tires.
Sticky.
And if you it's sticky and it seems to swell, and so if you drive through it, the mud just collects and collects and collects until you've got a ton of mud on your outfit, and of course you can't drive through it. And I was brought up never to drive into a mud puddle on the road because I probably couldn't drive out of it. But at any rate, it was an isolated world, and we didn't have phones until after World War II, or plumbing, or much in the way of communication except mail and visit from family members. And I don't remember my mother having women friends except women in the family. And I don't remember people coming to the ranch except family members.
The books are All But the Waltz. This is the first of the two memoirs, and the second is Balsam Root. We're talking today with Mary Clearman Blue about the writing of her memoir of five generations of a Montana family, and then the subsequent book, Balsam Root, that deals more intimately with her Aunt Imogene and her own life. This is Conversations. How did you come to write these books? What said to you these stories should come from you?
You know, I think I'd been preparing for these stories. I'd had them in my mind for a long time. I've written a couple of books of short stories, and some people say that when they go back and read the short stories, it seems like a source book for the essays that I was apparently trying them out in different forms. But when in 1987, I had been writing fiction off and on, and I was working in Montana. I'd had quite a few personal blows. My father had died in 1982 in a way that I just could never have predicted. If there's one thing I could have said about my father, it was that he was predictable, and his death was so unpredictable that I still hardly believe it. I also had remarried after a number of years and had a new baby, almost immediately with my pregnancy, we learned that my husband was suffering from pulmonary fibrosis, which is a progressive fatal disease of the lungs. Montana at that time fell into one of its periodic economic depressions, and I lost my job at the college where I'd been working for a long time. And
boy, everything at once.
So everything happened at once, about all I knew for sure was that I had to pick up and go on because I had a little girl to support who was, I think, about three in 1987. And so I moved over to Idaho and got a job teaching at Lewis Clark State College after the last 10 years in higher ed administration, which was in itself a challenge. I wasn't convinced I could still teach, and started over. Mm-hmm. And I was feeling really guilty about my husband, and I felt a lot of anguish I couldn't understand about my father's death, and I didn't understand where I was going or who I was or why I was alone at this stage in my life with this child. And I started looking back through the family stories for guidance. My grandmother had lost her husband to dementia, And she had gone on and supported him in a nursing home and supported her children and led her life. And one question I had when I started revisiting her life was, how did she do it? Mm-hmm. And could she tell me how? And would this give me the clues I needed to go on? About that time, I'd read a couple of essays by friends, and it crossed my mind, this is more interesting right now than short stories. I'm going to give it a try.
Uh-huh. Almost two things pulling you.
Yeah.
There were never any real clear answers. How?
Never, ever.
Yeah.
Never, ever. In my father's death, which I write about in All But the Waltz, and was one of the earlier essays I wrote in several versions, one of the hardest, he simply left home one day and never came back. He was 70 years old. He left the ranch to haul home a load of coal for his old coal stoke furnace. It was in September. The weather was reasonably good. He'd made the trip twice a year for 20 years, and he just didn't come back. And we eventually found his body, where he had driven off into eastern Montana and parked his truck and got out and lay down on a hillside and died.
Mm-hmm.
And none of us has any idea to this day exactly why that happened.
As you have researched and written about these people who are also your family members, mm-hmm. but are also these mm-hmm. people separate from you, if you haven't found answers how Mary raised her family mm-hmm. without her husband, how why your father went off as he did, mm-hmm. do you feel like you've met them in different ways, walked around your father differently for having looked at him so closely?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It seems to me that anytime you write about your memories, write about your experience, you transform it. And even if you don't come to a conclusion of some kind, even if you don't reach an answer, the fact that you've written about it and given it shape makes it different.
Mm-hmm.
And in my case, it made it easier to contain. It gave me...
In you.
Yeah, gave me a sense of meaning and a sense of control, I suppose, that I had never had.
Did it also, in some way, spread your roots out further? So you had you talked about looking for guidance when you began.
Mm-hmm.
And I've wondered whether things are more stable having all these stories around you in some way.
Well, I'm not sure. My life is much more stable now than it was a few years ago.
Right.
I never like to say that too loud because who knows what may happen next. But I have work I love and writing, and my daughter now is 12 and is a joy, and mm-hmm. I have friends and I like my life.
And this is all quite separate from all that process of research and work and writing. Let's read a bit from Balsam Root, if you don't mind, just to introduce people further to some aspects of the memoir. There's another dementia that features fully in Balsam Root, and maybe this is a good place to start.
Okay.
Would you introduce this section for us?
Yeah. I wrote this book because a few years ago, just when I thought everything had settled down, the woman who meant most to me in the whole world, the aunt who had always been the closest to me in the whole family, called me and told me she needed help. She had been living by herself for 30 or 40 years in Port Angeles, Washington, never married, absolutely the most independent woman I knew, and I would have said the happiest. And she called me and said that she wanted to come and live in Idaho near me. And at first I didn't understand. I didn't know why she would want to leave this independence in her house and this life she'd built. And when I went over to get her, I discovered that her mind was going, and that she was aware of it, and that she was trying to hide it, but she was also very frightened, and that she needed far more help than I realized. It fell to me to see her through the dementia, which ultimately led to a nursing home. But before we did that, we tried to keep her at home. And I was helped in this by my older daughter, Elizabeth, and the man she later married, her boyfriend, Brian. And this first section that I'll read will tell a little bit about what those days were like. I believe that Auntie is in love with Brian. No, don't laugh at this old woman, this stringy bag of bones and gristle, blear-eyed and messy and confused. Her face quivers with wattles, her shoulder blades jut out, her breasts hang somewhere in the neighborhood of her waist, but I've watched her mood lift when Brian walks into the room, seen her sparkle at him, seen her tender glance when he isn't looking. Only Brian can coax her out of her sulks, get her to cooperate with Julie and take her bath, get her to laugh. Elizabeth thinks that Auntie hates her, and I've observed her increasing surliness with Elizabeth, her mean jabs and little asides. What does Auntie think? That perhaps she can run off Elizabeth and keep Brian? But I'm not laughing at this old woman, who, even through the haze of her dementia, longs for just what I secretly long for, to love and to be loved. When Auntie's eyes soften and her lips move in an unconscious smile, I think I know, that she has drifted into the luxury of fantasy. But her fog is worsening. Some days she's reduced to mumbling. The meals she is eating, the location of her own bed fade out of her memory. Sometimes she cannot remember that she had started to get dressed. Early one morning, Elizabeth looks up from the breakfast she's cooking and is startled to see Auntie, clad in nothing but her undershirt, watching her from the kitchen door. Auntie, go put your clothes on. What? To keep her from straying outdoors, naked and disoriented, I come up with the idea of equipping the doorknobs with those plastic caps meant to thwart toddlers. Auntie, who has promised us solemnly not to try to go walking without a companion, darts for the front door the minute she sees her chance, runs up against the plastic cap on the knob, and weeps in frustration. They ought to be ashamed to lock in an old lady. There might be a fire, and I might be. She cannot find the words she needs. She weeps afresh. Oh, what did I ever do to deserve this?
This is a woman who was the liveliest of the family, mm-hmm. filled with energy, mm-hmm. filled with mm-hmm. fun.
Mm-hmm. By far the most adventurous, life-loving, interested in everything around her.
Can you take us back just a bit to some of the young life that Imogene had? There are some kind of pivotal events in her life that you were part of.
Well, she was born in 1910 on a Montana homestead. Her parents had just moved there from Iowa. They were among the very first to settle in that part of Montana, and they had no neighbors. It was a very very remote life at the time, and she grew up on the homestead. Her mother sent her to what was then called Normal School at Western Montana College in Dillon to get her teaching certificate, which she did. Mm-hmm. And she taught for many years in country schools in Montana. It looked like that would be her life, and I've been interested in what the country school teachers did, and I've went to a country school myself, and what their lives were like, and one of the things that they were pretty dead-ended. These were districts that would not give teachers tenure because they didn't want to mm-hmm. have any commitments to them. And salaries in the 1930s had gone from, say, $100 a month down to $30 a month, and when they paid it. And sometimes she wouldn't know she had a job until into September, and somebody would need a teacher at the last minute, and then they would call her. And that $30 a month was what stood between her and depending on her mother. Mm-hmm. I always thought she liked to teach, but after I'd read her diaries, I realized that this was not the life she wanted. Then a terrible thing happened. She was helping my father cut hay. And I can barely remember this. It's one of my earliest memories. She was mowing hay with a horse-drawn mower. And she was driving my dad's sorrel team. Sox and Babe, they were called, and they were undependable, and they ran away with her. Somehow, they pitched her off the mowing machine seat and into that sickle bar. And there are audiences where I have had to explain what those sickle bars look like, all those sharp teeth, you know, that are just wet to a razor's edge to cut the hay. And that sickle bar passed over her foot and nearly cut her foot off. She managed somehow to stop the team and tie them up and sit up and take out her boot string and tie a tourniquet around her own leg.
Tremendously gutsy woman.
Yeah. My father noticed she hadn't made her round, galloped over, got her into the back seat of her own car. They rushed her to the hospital, and that's one of my earliest memories, before they drove the car off, is looking over the back seat of that car and seeing her propped up in the back seat, and I will never forget her words. Look what they did to me, Mary. Mm. And she laughed.
Mm. In some ways, this accident that could have ended her life and could have left her a cripple dependent on the dole or her mother or your father changed her life
That's
for the
right.
better.
That's right, because she was fortunate enough to get an old Army doctor who pitched in, had seen wounds, and sewed her back together and connected the tendons. She walked with crutches for a long time, and nobody in Montana would hire her, in central Montana would hire her, because how could she do playground duty? How could she janitor schools and carry coal and water? So she applied in places where nobody had ever heard of her. And she applied on the West Coast just as women were going into the shipyards to work during World War II. And the superintendent's reaction was, a woman on crutches, at least she won't leave for the factories. And they hired her, and it meant a whole new life for her. Mm-hmm. It meant that she had a chance at decent wages and a life away from family and some security and a chance to have her own house and her own life. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
When she began to, what did you call it? There's this incredible line where you talk about Imogene falling into a hole in her mind, I think. Dementia began, how did this work on you? You had been, your daddy didn't want you to go to college. You'd persisted and gone for a PhD, even raising your first son and daughter, against the in-laws' advice, against your mother's best wishes, against your dad. You had said, no, I will paddle this boat by myself.
Yeah, I had.
Suddenly coming into your life is your most beloved relative who is in essence saying to you, I need everything you have.
That's right. And she had been the one, she had been the rock in my life. She lent me money when $100 meant the difference between being afloat and not. She was the one who encouraged me. She was the one who was my role model. She meant everything to me. To this day, I miss her more than I can tell you. Then she came to me, and that's essentially what she said. She said, not in so many words, but she said, you pretend for me. You help me cover up. You make it possible for me to go on living my life. And it will take all your energy. And I couldn't do it. I could not give her my life. And I felt enormously guilty. And I also felt angry. I felt so angry at her for doing this, as though she'd done it on purpose. And I knew that anger was irrational, but I was furious.
And still you pushed on. I mean, it was Elizabeth and Brian and you and this young woman you hired and homes and hospitals.
Mm-hmm. And we did all those things, and it got worse and worse, and the doctors told us it would continue to get worse, which in fact it did. Mm-hmm. We kept her at home as long as we could. We all had jobs. We hired a caretaker. She hated the caretaker. We tried to move her into a retirement village where she'd get what they call assisted care. Mm-hmm. She would have none of it. She trashed the place.
She ripped the place up.
She tore the curtains off the windows, and she kicked the aides and tried to beat up on them. And
there's a very nice line where she says, "I hope you're ashamed of me. Somebody should be." But there's this huge defiance.
Yeah, she was just, and I'll never forget going over. They'd called me frantically in the middle of the night, and I rushed over, and she was just sitting there glinting in satisfaction. She had beaten up on this aide. Here she is, 84 years old, and just a little shell of a woman, and just tough, you know. Just, I got in some good licks. So then came, we couldn't trust her not to run away, so then came eventually a locked room, the locked wing. And she had been drugged so much that for a while she seemed catatonic. We took her to the Alzheimer's wing. They said, "We think we can get her off the drugs and into physical therapy and get her back on her feet." And I signed, and they did. Mm-hmm. And the first thing she did when she got back on her feet was climb on her bed, somehow get a window open, climb out, drop about 8 feet to the ground, and take off. She was absolutely determined she would not quit.
It's interesting to me, your second husband, in his own way, did this same thing. He said, "I'm not going to be brought down by this. You can't tell me I've got this wasting disease. It's not affecting my mind. It's not affecting my lungs.
That's right.
I'm just fine.
In fact, I really don't have it.
In fact, I'll have an allergy.
I've been misdiagnosed.
Yeah,
I'm not going to take that medicine."
Yeah. In some ways, I am. It is... the spirit that won't be staunched is remarkable to me, not just in these two people, but in others in your book, as well as, it seems to me you're speaking also for the human condition. We just won't be torn down.
Yeah, and you know, even when my second husband was, when I didn't know what I was going to do, because his behavior got increasingly bizarre, I had to give him, I had to respect it in a admire it even. He was not going anywhere gentle. He was not going to go without a fight, and there was that about, I can remember almost in the midst of my despair, feeling kind of a pride in him, that he was absolutely. Absolutely not going to be affected by it.
I will farm this land. I will find oil. I will make us rich.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
We're talking on this edition of Conversations to Mary Clearman Blue. As you can tell, the memoirs we're talking about are extremely personal. They've been called rivetingly honest. They spare nothing in telling the truth. And as such, I think, become an insight, as I say, not just to this family, but to what people do when pressed, either by Montana or by illness or by the demands of one's family. Mm-hmm. Let me introduce you just a bit more to Mary Clearman Blue. I mentioned degrees. Her PhD, all her degrees are in English. Her PhD is in English from the University of Missouri at Columbia. Her bachelor's and master's from the University of Montana. She teaches now at the University of Idaho at Moscow, where she's professor teaching Renaissance literature and creative writing. Her books by Viking Penguin are Balsam Root, the most recent of which she's been reading from today, published in 1994. All But the Waltz is the other memoir we've looked at, subtitled A Memoir of Five Generations in the Life of Montana Family. That's available in paper from Penguin and was published in 1991. There are two collections of short stories and also a co-edited anthology of women's writings from the West. You're listening to Conversations on KUAC. We're talking with Mary Clearman Blue. I keep thinking as I'm reading that this process, not just of living, but of researching, the inner researching that you've done, has been a process of both toughening and softening. And I'm wondering if that's true for you, that you've said to yourself over the course of these years, boy, isn't life a pip, and don't we just have to be flexible to keep taking it? And on the other hand, there seems to be this rolling up of sleeves and fighting for what's yours.
Well, you know, I think that's very perceptive, your comment about the hardening and toughening, but also the softening. Mm-hmm. There's something to be said for realizing there is nothing you can do.
Mm-hmm.
And while I don't know that it makes any of us feel any better, we can all see somebody who's got it worse. I've never been in a situation where I didn't know that other people were suffering.
Mm. There's also this memory I have persistent from my reading of Edna, who uh-huh. is your grandmother, who's uh-huh. called Grammy, uh-huh. who has the sweetest, softest face mm-hmm. in her early pictures with mm-hmm. her husband. She mm-hmm. is soft-cheeked mm-hmm. yeah. and innocent-eyed, uh-huh. and she's dressed yeah. in this remarkable mm-hmm. flurry of ruffles uh-huh. and lace, uh-huh. almost mm-hmm. like a baby's gown.
Uh-huh.
And then this same woman is presented to me over and over mm-hmm. again as hard scrabble, mm-hmm. firm-muscled. She could beat mm-hmm. a full-grown young woman at mm-hmm. arm wrestling, mm-hmm. behind the plow and hauling mm-hmm. the water and mm-hmm. raising her kids after yeah. Alfred dies yeah. as a boy.
Yeah.
It seems to me that you must at some point in your reckoning say, well, this is my family, this is what
well,
we do.
Well, you know, what else is there? What you
yeah.
can live life or not, and I continue to feel like life is what we've got, and that we celebrate it, even if much of it doesn't seem worth celebrating. And some of the hard stuff I think is perhaps the most worth celebrating.
Mm-hmm.
I look at that picture of my grandmother, and I see that innocence of what lies ahead, and I see it in the faces of students. And I just wince at how much control they think they have
mm-hmm.
In their lives, and how little I feel I have,
yes.
and what will happen as the years go by.
Absolutely. It's interesting because you both have more, and you've referred
uh-huh.
to that, and less,
uh-huh.
and some
yeah.
awareness of
yeah.
both of those now.
Yeah.
Age is a helpful thing.
It's one of the few good things about getting older.
That's right. That's right. I want to ask you about the process of writing. You said at a craft talk mm-hmm. recently, and let me say to mm-hmm. Listeners at this point that Mary Clearman Blue is in Fairbanks early in April of 1995. Her visit, sponsored by the Alaska Humanities Forum, the Alaska State Council on the Arts, and the University of Alaska Fairbanks English Department Visiting Writers Program. At the craft talk during your visit, you said to a student that all this could have been therapy
mm-hmm.
were it not for the writing.
Mm-hmm.
And good therapy is not necessarily good writing. Did you know, before you knew about writing these books, that writing was the craft for your life? Because
oh,
it definitely
yeah.
seems to
oh,
be the craft
yes,
for your life.
Yeah, yeah. I began writing as a child, and I give a lot of credit to the advantages of growing up in a pre-television
mm-hmm.
West and without the enormous resources that I so envy my children of, but I think they take for granted. I fell back on books and fantasy and telling myself my own stories and being entertained by my grandmother's stories.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was what made a writer of me. And I always believed I'd be a writer. Wrote in high school and wrote short stories in college And I always thought I'd be a fiction writer. Mm-hmm. Creative nonfiction never occurred to me in those days, mm-hmm. but I always knew I would write.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how to ask this. Did the writing come along with the experience? Did you find yourself writing these essays on reflection or when you were in the middle of?
Both.
Yeah.
Both. I started writing about my aunt in Balsam Root almost in progress. It was almost a form of a journal. Mm-hmm. And I think that I began starting after she had been committed to the locked ward. But she wasn't dead by any means. It wasn't as though I could say this is an experience that has had closure.
This is done.
And it wasn't anything that I'd had any time to reflect on. And I remember worrying a little bit about that. I'll often tell students, give yourself a little time between the event and writing about it. But that wasn't the case here, and I worried that I was trying to do something too soon, but I felt absolutely driven to do it. And I wrote about the first 80 pages just in, it wasn't in one sitting, but that was only because I had to get up and take care of Rachel and you know, and do the things we all do. But it was in a hard, concerted blast of effort, and then felt as though I could back off. And many people have told me that there's a kind of a change of pace mm-hmm. in the middle of the book where I get through the ordeal of bringing my aunt back to Idaho and trying to take care of her at home and then institutionalizing her. And then I draw a deep breath, and while I'm still visiting her and still taking care of her bills and her legal affairs and so forth, then it's as though I've got a little time to look back and say, how can I get in touch with her? Is there any way I can reach her in this fog? Mm-hmm. And I try to through the past, through my memories and her diaries.
And you could from time to time.
And I could from time to time. Yeah. And I found I was doing what a psychologist has told me actually has a name. It's called reminiscence therapy. And it has to do with talking to people about the past, which apparently is very good for them. She could remember things that had happened to her in her girlhood when she couldn't remember that she'd had lunch.
I wonder if that is stabilizing for the person who's beginning to slip away and is conscious of that slippage.
I would think it would have to be. It must be. It must have the terror of nightmare to wake up and not know where you are, mm-hmm. or how long you've been there, or what kind of a frame of reference is around, not to recognize any face. It must just be terrifying. She was greatly relieved to see older members of her family. Her sister came to see her, and she knew her. And she wondered where my grandmother was. Uh-huh. And she wondered where the other girls were. And she couldn't remember who had died and who hadn't. And the worst of it was she knew she couldn't remember. And she would ask me, is Irvin dead? Is Sylvia dead?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This book is much more, the material in this book is much more available to you because you mm-hmm. were there. Mm-hmm. Elizabeth, your elder daughter, was mm-hmm. there. Rachel mm-hmm. was there. Brian mm-hmm. was there. Mm-hmm. And to a certain extent, Imogene was there. Mm-hmm. So all the references are there mm-hmm. to write about. Mm-hmm. When you were writing in parts of this book and in All But the Waltz, you're doing a reconstruction mm-hmm. largely. You talked at the...
Yeah.
Craft talk about building a quilt uh-huh. where you put all these pieces in a jar until the mm-hmm. jar is full enough to start making mm-hmm. something out of mm-hmm. it. But there's always so much missing. Mm-hmm. I suppose this is a question not about, again, about these personal experiences, mm-hmm. but about the process of creative nonfiction. Mm-hmm. Were there places that you knew you could create to leap from one piece of information to another, and places where the road was just blocked for you?
Yeah, there were. And I'm not trying to do an oral history. I try to be faithful to my sources, and if I quote exactly, I want it to be exact, and I try to I try to respect my scholarly background and
right. And
be as exact as I can. There is so little that we can be absolutely certain of, whether it's the newspaper obituary that tells a conflicting story with an article from another source, or whether it's the family story that is told in a different way from another family story, or in one case I'd heard family stories about an incident that I later researched through the local newspaper files and it came out much differently, and I'm left wondering, was the reporter right, or was the family story right, or maybe there's another version? And what I've tried to do is to respect that. And if I don't know, I can do a number of things. One thing I can do is surmise.
Mm-hmm.
I can do an imaginative reconstruction, but I can also say I don't know. And sometimes that seems to me the most useful answer.
Mm-hmm.
Here are some possibilities, but I will never know.
It's an interesting point that I think I trusted, if that's the right
uh-huh.
word, your narratives
uh-huh.
for those reasons.
Mm-hmm.
You would tell me a story and then
mm-hmm.
stop and say, but then when I told it to my dad, he said it was all in my head, it
yeah.
never happened.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'd tell me another mm-hmm. story and you'd say, this might not
mm-hmm.
have been, but this feels
yeah.
like.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and we know more than we think. The details add up to more than we think. As long as we're very careful to remember always it's our own construct.
Mm-hmm.
And we are all fiction writers all the time, writing our own stories,
mm-hmm.
Explaining to ourselves why we're doing things, reconstructing and telling the story in a little different way. Well, I should have said to him. Turns into, I think maybe I really did say it to him.
And when I said to him.
And when I said it to him.
Sure. Sure.
And, you know, we just have to be aware that that's going on all the time and try to, as you say, be honest. I want my readers to trust me. I think that's an important thing between a reader and a writer.
Okay.
On the other hand, we are all writing fiction.
Is that where the ethic lies? I'm wondering how you define your personal ethic when it comes to what is the truth. When you know you're speaking of a truth that is shifting ground, how do you know when it's true when you've written?
It's I would say that a fictional truth to me, a mythic truth, is true when it has meaning. People talk about how it feels true.
That's what I was just I thought of resonance and thought of my heart, so that's the feeling
that
would be true.
Yeah, something like that.
Right.
And I think of that in terms, say, of fairy tales.
Hmm.
I don't think that, I don't think we really believe there was a Cinderella or a Sleeping Beauty, but I do think that the stories have a truth for us. And I think we're affected by those well-known stories. And I think there's a reason why they've stayed vivid through generations and generations and generations, because they're telling us something that is true.
Mm-hmm. And good fiction, no matter what the subgenre is,
it tells
true.
Us something that
of
is
some
true.
Sort, yeah.
That's right. Though we expect it to be imaginative, and we're ready to let it be set on Mars if the writer wants it to be,
right,
and,
yeah.
and if we're interested, we'll go along and see what it's like, and as long as we're held by that sense that we're of truth that we're getting, a break that and we toss the book down, and that's that.
Mm-hmm.
But in creative nonfiction, it seems to me, and I know that all writers don't agree, but for my own purposes. What I operate on the basis of is okay, nothing's absolutely true, but there are some things that we better know something about. For example, I feel like my knowledge of Montana history, Western history in general, and the Montana homestead frontier in particular is really important, that I have a solid historical background for the people that I'm interested in. One thing, it answers some of those unanswerable questions. Oh, well, that was the year that they had the big dust storm. Uh-huh. That was why they did thus and such. Mm-hmm. Also, to the extent anything in this life is variable, we can say that there was a depression that started in 1929. And I don't think unless I'm moving into a parallel universe, I want to play around with that. Mm-hmm. And that comes down to little things. I've done some pretty obscure work in local history. And I want it to be right to the extent I can get it right. I don't feel I've got the fiction writer's freedom to take one tribe of Indians and move them over the mountains and mix customs up or invent a war if I need one, add characters that never existed. I don't think I've got that freedom. On the other hand, I do have interpretive freedom. And I need to be very careful about that. I need to let my reader know if I'm interpreting. I need to let the reader know if this is something that he or she could verify and pin down. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a good deal to be said for the importance of the writers letting the reader know right away what the terms are.
Mm-hmm. Are you in that way writing with the reader with you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is I don't know whether this is an odd question or not. You write in Balsam Root of I can't remember the phrase you used, but it's a wonderful phrase about how the women in your family don't talk about anything mm-hmm. that means anything to them. Mm-hmm. That's close. Mm-hmm. Did you ever feel like you were transgressing?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Certainly. Absolutely. And I talk to students all the time who feel the same way. They act as though, and I know exactly how they feel because I feel that way, they act as though they are somehow doing something wrong. They are breaking some rule by telling these things, by writing, by speaking up. And they feel as though they are doing something very risky and very scary. And I have felt that way all along.
Not just once?
Not just once, but constantly.
Uh-huh.
And that it's not only better left unsaid, but if you say it, it makes it real in a way that it wasn't before. It could have been discounted before. If I interpret my aunt as having a secretive streak, then somehow she does. Whereas if I had never said it in print, it wouldn't quite be true. It wouldn't quite be real. Somehow writing about it, and this is one of the powers of writing, somehow writing about it validates it, makes it real, makes it true. But it's also the big risk.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, it always transforms it. But absolutely, I have felt that I was betraying my family, that I was being indecent, that I was really transgressing. And I have a feeling that women have often been told to be quiet. But interestingly, recently, it's the women who have been interested in writing personal essay and have been speaking out. And sometimes it's the men who feel uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
By no means all men.
Mm-hmm. But there's a new voice.
That's right.
Yeah.
An unexpected one. And I think everybody is stopping and say, wait a minute, what is this voice? And why is this voice telling us about things we'd rather not know, like family misery? And wouldn't it be better to write about something more objective? Why not go trout fishing or backpacking and write about that?
Right.
And
happy life in early
Yeah,
Montana.
which is fine. Sure. I have nothing at all, no quarrel at all about writing about these things. Mm-hmm. But I also feel as though there's a way in which it's a little safer.
Mm-hmm. From a reader's point of view, of course, there is a wonder at seeing this other side of Montana, mm-hmm. the Montana that's not just
yeah.
big sky country or mm-hmm. romantic cowboys, mm-hmm. but what the women endured and what the men endured mm-hmm. and where the dreams met reality. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the maybe more importantly, in a time when people in their middle age are having to turn and care for mm-hmm. parents and aunts and mm-hmm. siblings, mm-hmm. there's an importance in reading about one family's struggle
yeah.
with dementia in mm-hmm. this generation and in this generation. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I guess if I've got any kind of way of going through life, it is look it in the face. Can't be worse than what you might imagine it is.
Did anybody in your family say, oh, hush, Mary, stop that?
No, actually. And I had made up my mind that it was my story to tell and that I would tell it regardless. My mother is not a woman who reads, and she is not pleased with the idea of doing what she calls raking up the past. But she has not overtly criticized me. Mm-hmm. I give my manuscripts to my sister and to my older daughters, litmus tests, and they have both said things like, "We didn't quite see it this way, but we respect your point of view."
Yeah.
And that's been wonderful. That's been a tremendous help. It would be very hard if they had told me, this is wrong. Mm-hmm. Be quiet or we'll never forgive you.
Mm-hmm. Would you like to read again?
Sure.
We're coming close to our very quick hour, but I
okay.
think it would be nice to have another section of this book to offer.
Let's turn to the back if we're running a little late. And what I'd like to read is just a little bit about my older daughter and me doing some horseback riding. And after the worst was over with my aunt and we were getting ourselves back together again, we found that we wanted to regroup and get to know each other. And one of the ways we did this was by doing a lot of horseback riding that spring along the Snake River in Idaho, where I lived for several years. And we were riding mares that we had brought over from Montana that my father raised. And
people should know you were raised on horseback.
Yeah, I was raised on horseback.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Raised my older daughter on horseback.
Okay.
Elizabeth is my older daughter, and we're riding horseback after the worst of the difficulties with my aunt. Elizabeth and I ride along the rim of the Bear Hill that looms above the Snake River. Leftover rain clouds roll off to the south, purpling the outcroppings of volcanic rock, but the late sun has broken out to streak the deep grass of Idaho. If I were to look back, I would see the rooftops of Lewiston and Clarkston far below us, and the green foliage of trees on both sides of the confluence of slow rivers, the Snake and the Clearwater, and their bridges remote and small, and the distant curls of smoke rising over the pulp mill like an unreadable message in the gray haze. But I don't look back. Up here is sky and dry weeds, a good trail, and sensations I thought I had forgotten. The mares have been ridden too little this spring, and they dance and spook at pheasants and badger holes and trash, for we are never out of the sound of traffic up here, never out of sight of the housing developments. And yet I can imagine how we must look from far below, from one of those new subdivision decks, perhaps, if one happened to glance up and spot those ospreys wheeling in the wind currents above the rocks. And then, far away, the two women on horseback, sun glinting on the tails of the sorrel on the bay, just before they disappear into the tawny grass, like a last glimpse before a page is turned. Memories of horses are like patches of film on high-speed reverse, I get no more than a glimpse of the dark mare waiting at the end of the lane with her head down. Her life outran mine, as have the others. I see my father working cattle on Pardner. The old brown gelding's cow sense tells him which way a yearling heifer is going to dodge before she does it. He swaps ends to head her off, his long brown head and his long forelegs doubling back against the momentum of his hindquarters. How can a horse so ungainly be so quick? The lives of horses run parallel to ours in a different dimension of time. The muzzles of horses lift from the water trough, turning and dripping, ears pricked toward a voice, hazel-flecked eyes watching the carrier of oats through a dazzle of sun in slow motion. 25 of our years is a horse's lifetime. Perhaps that's why they seem so vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. This is Balsam Root, Mary Clearman Blue's most recent book, published in 1994 by Viking Press. I mentioned earlier a collection of, an anthology. It's also a 1994 book, also from Viking Penguin, and it's called Circle of Women, an Anthology of Women's Writing in the West, co-edited with Kim Barnes. Mm-hmm. Several books from Mary Clearman Blue. Also a couple books of short stories we'll mention before we go away. Do you have any nostalgia for the times that are gone from your Montana / Idaho life? Or is it all still there for you? This is a yearning piece you read.
I have a certain sense of grief for what I think of as the precious trivial. The odds and ends, the place names that have disappeared off the maps and exist only in the minds of one or two old men or women. The names of horses. The forgotten places in my childhood where cattle had rubbed the barks off the bottoms of willow boughs and I loved to play. Those kinds of lost things. Mm-hmm. I really object to a kind of sentimentality that glamorizes what I saw as very harsh, and while in some ways I imagine it was stiffening, it was also limiting and narrow and anti-intellectual, mm-hmm. and impoverished. I don't see that those are things to glamorize. Mm-hmm. And I often feel very irritated at the people I see coming into Montana and Wyoming and Idaho and also Alaska who say, oh, isn't that cute or quaint?
Right. Wearing their new boots and their hats.
Yeah.
I have wondered this while reading both these books. Do you have any sense of your grandmother's, both maternal and paternal, and Emma Jean, as having somehow thrown you into your future? It seems to me that Mary's determination that her daughters, plural, would be educated, and that both from her and from Grammy, the determination that you would read, you and your sisters would read, that you would be more than this patch of earth you stood on. Mm-hmm. Is there any sense that they pushed from behind in some ways?
Well, certainly my mother's mother did. Yeah. She believed that every woman should be educated and be able to take care of herself. And she wanted all her daughters to have that kind of independence. She wanted them to be able to earn a paycheck.
This is not a thought that was coexistent with the time she lived in.
Not really. But she said she talked it over with her husband, and his sisters had been uneducated and were helpless. He didn't want his daughters to grow up like his sisters, and they sent them to college at God knows what sacrifice. Mm-hmm. And they all got teaching certificates, which was the, you know, one of the few avenues toward independence they could get. One of those years when Imogene was agonizing about whether she would get a $30 or a $40 a month teaching job, She thought she wouldn't, and she checked in at the laundry in Lewistown to see if she could work there, and it turned out they'd pay her something like 25 cents an hour.
Yeah.
And so there just wasn't.
Boy, I bet you that was anything. The recognition of the value of her education.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
We've run us out of time. Uh-huh. You're working on a novel now.
Yes, I am.
And it's in what stage?
Well, I have about 50 polished pages and a lot of junk and a pretty clear idea of where it's going.
Oh, so this is wonderful to have a clear idea of where it's going, huh? Uh-huh. A new step.
Yeah.
You're still teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be ongoing and more
writing. I expect to. I like to teach, and I am enjoying the University of Idaho now that I'm there, and I expect to teach for a while anyway.
Mm-hmm. Any more essays?
I write essays all the time for one reason or another, and I've got it in the back of my mind. I may want to pull something together one of these days, but right now all I really want to do is work on that novel.
Yeah. Well, the memoir is complete, at least from the reader's point of view.
Yeah. I don't feel any. I don't feel like there's anything left that I want to re-explore in these books.
Yeah. A new genre, and a new story. Let me leave you with a few notes on Mary Clearman Blue. Once again, the books Balsam Root and All But the Waltz are the memoirs of her family. Read All But the Waltz first and Balsam Root second, because that's the way you do it. They're both from Viking Penguin, one in 1991, one in 1994. All But the Waltz was given the Pacific Northwest Booksellers Award in 1991, as was Runaway, her second book of short fiction collections, which came out in 1990 from Confluence Press. Mary Clearman Blue has twice won the Montana Award in the Humanities for contributions to the humanities in that state, and also the H.G. Merriam Award for Distinguished Contribution to Montana Literature. There's a nomination for a Pushcart Prize and a couple of other awards for her short stories. Short stories, once again, the first Lambing Out was a 1977 book, but look for the short story collection Runaway from Confluence. Also, the Circle of Women, an anthology of women's writing in the West. You can find Mary Clearman Blue at the University of Idaho, where she is a professor of English. I want to thank you very much for your time with us today.
Thank you.
It's a real enjoyable hour. I'm Susan McGinnis. This has been Conversations, and I hope you join us again next week. Thanks.